Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another reading meeting, a summer reading meeting. We appreciate you taking time out of a Sunday to join us. And today, we are very excited to welcome Dr. Devin Kearns to talk with us about who knows what, all sorts of wide-ranging things that he's an expert in and the things that he and Mark have worked on together. So thanks for joining us. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are for people who don't know?
Yeah. Well, thanks again for having me. I'm really excited to chat with you. This is such a great idea to something informal and fun. So I'm an associate professor of special education at the University of Connecticut, and I study reading disabilities and do research on instruction, and I'm really excited about the intersection of psychology and cognitive science, neuroscience, and instruction, and something I know Mark is really interested in too. And so, which is how we got kind of connected too. So I think that's enough about me. I used to be a teacher too. I taught for 7 years in the Los Angeles area.
And you've spent a good part of your career on issues that are really at the intersection between research and what happens in the classroom.
Definitely. And my work goes back to some of the things in my teaching, you know, like this thing about syllables, you know, you and I have talked about that started when I was a teacher. Like, I didn't understand why we were doing this. I was explaining it to kids and I was like, is this really useful? You know, so that's why I'm so excited about this intersection.
So we know you've worked on many, many things, and there's a lot of topics to talk about. So I was hoping to maybe start off with some issues that you raised in a paper that appeared last year in Reading Research Quarterly about syllabification strategies.
Yeah.
And you know, the research itself is extremely interesting, and it represents a kind of research people might not be that familiar with, and also it raises questions about whether we use the same strategies for kids who are struggling as we do for kids who are on a quote unquote more typical trajectory. And so, and what kinds of research are really relevant to instructional practice? So it seemed like a really great taking off point for a lot of interesting issues. So can you tell people a little bit about the work that you did, and then maybe we can talk about it a bit?
Yeah. So if you want, Molly, do you want me to, maybe I just show that slide, two slides as examples. Let me see if I can do that and kind of get us started. So what I was interested in is syllable division patterns. And as many people here will know, there are often they have a 6 or sometimes 7 syllable types, and you can use information about those to read words. And some of the most important ones and ones that get focused on a lot are open and closed syllables, which are defined by whether there's a vowel at the end or a consonant following the vowel. An open syllable has a vowel at the end, closed syllable has a vowel, consonant at the end, and open syllable has a vowel at the end, and it's supposed to affect the pronunciation. So let me show you the examples of these. So the question in the study was the pronunciation of the first vowel, that's V1, in words that have a vowel, 2 consonants, and another vowel. And so the idea is to follow this pattern. So let me show you how the pattern works. So the idea is that if you have a word that has this pattern, you break it in between the 2 consonants. And because you then have this first syllable, the closed syllable, this vowel has the short pronunciation. And so that works in words like rabbit. So you break rabbit between the, following the rule, between the Bs. And now that first vowel is, the first syllable is a closed syllable, and the vowel is short and says rab. And you can do the same, and then fodder is another example of that. You can do the same thing where you have a vowel, 1 consonant, and another vowel, and the pattern here is like this. So if you have that pattern, you break it between the first vowel and the consonant, and that makes the first syllable open and therefore having a long vowel. So we take a word like tiger, we can apply the pattern, divide it here, the I has a long vowel sound and it says tie. And that works really well for words like tiger and focus, but then there are words like novel where it doesn't follow the pattern, where here you have an O that says the short sound, even though it has the VCV pattern. And this is just an example of a whole bunch of words that do and don't follow the pattern. And so you can see here, there are words that do, you can read the list there. You have long vowel sounds with the in the first vowel position, because those are open syllables, but here are words, the same vowels that don't have the same pattern. And then there are a bunch of examples of ones, especially with R, where it's really hard to know whether it's an open or closed syllable. I love the example of Mary. If you're from where I am, that vowel is long. But lots of other people think it's an R sound, like Mary. So in any case, those are examples of the complexity of this and why I concluded in the paper that, you know, these patterns aren't necessarily a good strategy to teach following those rules, because, or people call them rules or patterns, because they don't work as often as people would like. And so I sort of questioning whether or not that was a good idea. And as I said before, that was based on my own experience thinking about that as a teacher. I did it and started to wonder, is this a really good idea?
And so that's, I think the important thing about your study is you decided to count. I mean, you treated it as an empirical question. I mean, it's a question of fact, right? I mean, to what extent do the words that a kid is going to encounter in early reading and you know, through grade 5, through grade 8, whatever your point you want to stop, to what extent are the words that they're going to have to know? Do they conform to these patterns or not? We tend to rely heavily on the examples that work.
Yeah, so absolutely.
What happens when you look?
Yeah, I mean, right. That was the idea, is sort of to understand that. And it turns out there are a lot of examples where it doesn't work. It says the opposite vowel. And there are a lot of cases also where it says the schwa sound, like that sort of reduced vowel sound. In fact, in some cases, that's the most frequent one. And so it's really hard to, you know, have a rule when you have both these opposite words, or it says the short one should say the long, and then it says schwa. And even that's what actually makes the VCCV rule inconsistent, if it is at all, because with a few exceptions, the VCCV words work where the first syllable is closed. But if you include schwa, like, you know, it reduces the consistency by like 20%, because so many words, even with two vowels in the middle, have a reduced vowel in the first syllable. So, you know, so that's really complicates things.
So just a little bit more detail, maybe. Of course, you're looking at two of, you know, six or seven rules, but just considering these two, the suggestion was that the VCCV one worked better than the V/CV one, correct?
Yep.
But it's not 100%. And when you looked at, when you counted the data in your paper, the number of times words that conform to that VCCV pattern was like 86 or some high number, right?
Yeah.
But was that done just the, did you take into account the frequencies of the words, or was that just counting each word as one?
That, so the editors insisted that I reduce the length of the paper. So originally there was more emphasis on counting by frequency, but in the end it ended up just being total counts because of the complexity of doing it the other way. The patterns, the concern holds up even when you frequency weight it. But
So the idea, folks, was, you know, well, it's true. If you look at all of the words that fit this pattern, there might be some exceptions, but what if they're just the uncommon words that are irregular? And I guess, Devin, what you're saying is, well, no, it's not just like that. It's a pretty consistent pattern. The thing is, I protest, man. I mean, the rabbit case only works because there's a little bit of cheating there.
Right.
So I think that case is really worth thinking about a lot more. So rabbit is supposed to be a closed initial syllable, R-A-B, and therefore that correctly predicts that it'll have a short vowel. But right. That's not phonologically accurate. So the first right. syllable in the pronunciation, the word rabbit as it's spoken is not rab. We do not say rabbit. We say rabbit. And so the syllable boundary there in speech is very clear. It's an open initial syllable. It's mm-hmm. after the initial vowel. So to get the rule to work in the rabbit type cases, we use a spelling convention. We say, well, if there's a double letter, we're going to divide it up. You think there's any problem with teaching kids that the syllabification is one thing when it's spelled and it's something else when it's pronounced?
I think that's a tricky question. I think that it's such a common convention, like it's used in so many words, especially including when you add like, you know, an ing to a word, right? You know, you're adding a syllable, but you want to preserve the pronunciation of the first, you want to make sure it's clear that that first vowel continues to maintain its, you know, short sound. And since we have this convention that occurs so often, and as I actually found, it works really well, it's useful to preserve that boundary, even if linguistically it doesn't really work that way. I mean, I've done some other work on sort of like adjusting pronunciations too. And I think, you know, that work shows that if you teach kids to sound, you know, sound at rab and bit, part of what you have to do in language anyway, if you do sounding out, is you have to find a way to put them together. And it's always gonna be a little sleight of hand. Even if the word is like kitten, you know, it's not kit and 10, you know, when you put it together, it's a whole different thing. You know, you've got that, whatever it is, I think it's a flap in there, right? So
right, there's a level of phonetic detail that we're entirely ignoring cool. here. I guess the other thing is, okay, so there's a rule that's more or less consistent, and it's made consistent by a small cheat, which is just to use the orthographic pattern to make things work. And you know, okay, maybe it's helpful, but we can't. I mean, we don't want to judge the efficacy of the system on the basis of. We want to look at all of the cases. If we're going to give the kids a general strategy, or adults, if we're going to give people a strategy of dividing things into syllables, we need to know how well it works for all of the rules we're teaching them. And you know, there's a best case, and then there are ones that are not as good. The V/CV one seems like really to be, how often did it work on your account? And then what are the exceptions to it like? So there's label, so it's supposed to be a long A, but then there's cabin, which is supposed to be a long A, but it's not, or habit, which is supposed to be a long A, but it's not. And there's a lot of those. Again, in your account, I suppose it was more than half of the words do follow the pattern, but then there's a bunch that don't.
Yeah, it really depended actually. For the letter E, it actually turned out that there were more exceptions than there were rules. So when it was actually only 18% of cases where there was a letter E that it said the long sound as it was supposed to, a lot of them were schwa sounds. So E is used as a schwa sound a lot. And so it was really kind of, once you got down to just the short and long pronunciations of E, it was still less than 50%. So, you know, sort of like in that case, better off teaching the VC and then break it. And I think, you know, people will sometimes say, you know, well, couldn't you teach them two rules? You've got the V, you know, CV, and then the second one. And I've often said, well, why teach a rule at all, right? I mean, if you have these two things, like, is there really a rule, or might there be another way to kind of get at the same thing?
Yeah, you discussed this in the paper, and it just seems to me to illustrate the garden of forking paths here. In order to make this work, you're going to have to make it more complicated. So if you have two rules for words that have the VCV pattern, how does the kid know which one to apply?
Totally.
Well, they can try one and see if it's pronounce it to themselves and see if it sounds right. They could try the other one and pronounce it to themselves and see if it, I mean, this strikes me as a rule. Now you've got one pattern, VCV, that's going to be associated with two alternatives.
Yep.
Each of which applies in some cases for unknown reasons. It seems to me this is making the system more complicated. The kid has more to learn here, and it's basically creating a whole new category of, like, which ones are the rule governed cases, which are the exceptions, which rule do I apply? It's like creating a lot of words. Like, it seems to make things, it saves the idea of using syllable boundaries to predict pronunciation, but at the cost of making it a lot more complicated.
I think that's right. You know, and I actually was remembering as you were saying that, that in some of these programs that teach this, there are actually like backup rules too. So like one is like, even for VCCV, like chicken. So, you know, the CK, like, what do you do then? And the rule is that if you have a digraph, then you break it after the digraph, right? And then the other one is like with a consonant cluster, like in secret, you have the CR, and then the rule there is, let's see, how is that? Yeah, so even though it has a VCCV, you break it after the E because you have the CR. So, you know, it just ends up, it just spirals into a lot of other things. And the question is like, could we, you know, do something different that would?
And that's the question that's starting to show up in the chat. And I think, you know, there's a couple of things to directions here for this. One is, first of all, people, this approach is very common. It is used pretty widely. And so one might look at why people have embraced the idea and what its origins were and who it might be effective for. That is, even if it's not, you know, these rules aren't very good, you're still gonna have to memorize exceptions or decide which rule applies when it's ambiguous, you know, like in the VCV case. But maybe it's still necessary for some kids, for example, struggling readers. So one could ask, well, what was the history of this? Is it effective for certain kids? What are the certain beginning readers? Is it something that we that might be useful for certain kids, but not something that you wanted to incorporate as part of your curriculum, your approach for, say, kids who are following a more typical sort of developmental trajectory? So where did this come from? I mean, how did people learn to read, like you or me, before the syllable types were taught? What can you give us some history here and some sense of, I should tell people who are starting to come up with lots of questions in the chat, I haven't said what I endorse here about what to do for kids who are struggling versus kids who are on a quote, more typical trajectory. That's the issue I'm hoping we're gonna discuss so that we can get to some conclusion. So where did this come from, Devin? And what do we think about, you know, if you're being generous, you say, well, it works for some kids who might not be succeeding with other kinds of methods.
Yeah. So, I mean, really far back, there is sort of a like linguistic piece to this, right? Where, at, you know, if you think about some words, a lot of syllable final vowels say the long sound, like he and me. And the same thing is true with O. It's really the two that work the most, like, you know, go and so on. And so I think that, you know, that was maybe the genesis of it. It seems to apply to other words, probably for the same linguistic reason. And I don't exactly know, as is often the case, chat probably knows better than I do, but it seems that a lot of the spread of it came from Orton Gillingham. And Orton Gillingham, I think, included it for what was, I think, the right reason. I'm still not convinced it's the right answer, but I think that the intention was to simplify the structure of the language. Now, the way that the language is simplified was by creating a lot of additional work with the syllable division and these patterns and so on. That's a lot of stuff. And I saw, you know, Sarah Hart says it's in the reading source book. It's also in the Common Core State Standards, right? So this has been widely applied. But I think it started with Orton Gillingham and really the attempt to make the language seem more consistent, seem more regular. Even if it turns out not to be, there might be, arguably, this is kind of the argument made by some folks, including Dolch, who said, I think in the 50s, like the value in teaching, you know, syllable, sort of like he called it dictionary-based syllabification, is that it gives you a point of entry, right? Gets you started. And the idea might be that if you are a very poor reader, if you have reading difficulty, if you know, I don't want to, you know, it's person first language. If you're a person with reading difficulty, then, you know, especially really serious reading difficulty where a lot of things haven't worked for you, having something to kind of sink your teeth into it might be useful. And if you give the kid a lot of words, the adult too, a lot of words that follow the pattern, even if it's not universal, it might start to build your confidence that will kind of, you know, sort of weave its way into other, you know, sort of like build your confidence enough that you can get started. Even if you end up not being right, it gives you a point of entry, right?
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Oh, no.
One of the things you said there was this is a child who's struggling probably because there's a developmental condition that's making it difficult to learn to read. You've exhausted, and the important thing is they've gotten quality instruction in which there's been other approaches, and they are, you know, just doing more of the same is not helping that kid. And so at that point, you know, giving them a meta strategy, that is giving them the high level knowledge of, oh, well, this is the being able to describe syllable types, which is a kind of, you know, high level, conscious, explicit knowledge of linguistic structure. For those kids, it can be justifiable. I think, as you said, though, the first line of attack has to be doing as good a job as possible with trying to get the child in to the system successfully without having to give them that extra sort of instruction in how the language works and the sort of meta level analysis. Because clearly people can learn to read without knowing about the syllable types. I don't know the syllable types.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, even if you do something like this, I think there are other ways to do it. So one of my favorite reading programs, and this is an endorsement, I'm gonna endorse it anyway, not endorse it. I'm just gonna say I like it just because I have nothing, you know, I have no stake in it, but I really wish I created this program. It's called Rewards. It was designed by Anita Archer, who will be known to many folks, and her colleagues. And what's cool about it is they basically take the idea of this and they talk about like kind of open and closed syllables. That's kind of the end of it. And they basically teach kids to kind of pull off a syllable and then to sort of like try an option, whether it's short or long for the vowel, you know, you make it the open or you make it the close, and you might be right and you might be wrong. But the idea there is that it becomes a flexibility strategy rather than being this you know, set of rules. You can kind of pull it off one way, pull it off the other way, see which gets you the right answer. And what I think is great about that is they teach that explicitly in her program. They call it the overt strategy. And then they switch over to what they call the covert strategy, which I love because it's sort of like they designed as sort of an online, as you're actually reading kind of strategy where you can just, you know, you're like, okay, I don't remember exactly, I'll do my kind of pull it apart type thing. And that can really kind of accomplish the goal of giving you kind of a way in without layering on top of it all this other stuff, which you could argue is so cognitively intensive that, you know, it's like really not useful. And I said in the paper, and I think this is a controversial comment, but I'll just repeat it because there are no data on, you know, context clues showing it's effective or on looking at pictures. But one of the things I thought as I was writing this is like, the amount of cognitive load involved in doing this process and the degree to which it distracts you from actually reading the text is so great. You could argue that like it's as bad as context clues, you know what I mean? And so I don't know that that's true. I don't want to make that statement too broadly because like context clues are not a good idea for word recognition, but this seems to have some of the same problems as that.
I think so. I really totally agree with you. So the issue is, you know, costs and benefits, right? So, you know, the benefit of, for example, giving an alternative strategy, letting the kid have something else in their toolbox, maybe if they're struggling, they could apply some knowledge of syllables. The issue is that the instruction and then the use, the application of that knowledge when the kid's reading takes the kid out of reading. That is to say, it's looking at the act of reading rather than reading itself.
Right.
And to me, especially when these rules get complicated and have all sorts of exceptions, and you go this way if it's this kind of pattern, but then you go this way if it's that kind of pattern, this is explicit sort of knowledge. It's something you have to memorize. It's kind of an arbitrary rule. And then the application of it, the division into the parts and so on, is taking you out of the reading activity. And I guess my basic sense is, you know, that's the opposite. Maybe that's a path towards fluency. Maybe that's a path towards skill. Maybe that's necessary for some kids. I'm withholding judgment about that right now. But it's not the short path to being fluent. It's anything that sort of has you thinking about the solution rather than doing it is really, can at best be, you know, a step along the way. Remember, the goal here is that the all this word level stuff is supposed to basically be like a reflex in which you compute the meaning or pronunciation or what other information associated with the word really quickly without having to think about it. So I'm very, very skeptical. I'm not particularly picking on Orton Gillingham here at all, but I'm skeptical about strategies that take kids out of reading. I'm not saying it won't never be effective for anyone, but I would certainly, let's talk about the related issue. This kind of activity that might have originated with kids who are struggling, for whom other kinds of instruction were not working, it gets ported over into general education. I mean, just teaching kids in general. And there, this, do you think that that's true? I mean, it's in the Common Core standards for something that should be done with all kids, that every kid should know the syllable. I don't know what actually is stated about this that strikes me as really, really problematic, both because the rules don't work very well, because of the overhead associated with learning them, the other things you could be learning instead, the other sorts of approaches you could get to figuring out the pronunciations and learning the pronunciations of words, and the idea that it's necessary, because it's not, I mean, clearly it's not. Generations mm-hmm. of people learn to read fine without knowing this.
Right.
So if it's migrating over into the general curriculum approach to reading instruction, I'd like to hear from people who really strongly disagree. I think that this is making reading a kind of, it's giving kids like a lot of information about reading and about words, and it's less about the procedures that you need to and the knowledge you need to acquire to be able to read things accurately and fluently. I think it's really questionable whether the benefits come close to what the costs are.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Mara or Mara, syllable division, hard to know which way to say it, but you know, you asked us to clarify what students we're talking about. I think with regard to, you know, maybe there's a potential value in teaching this, might be for kids who are really struggling. I would say in terms of, I mentioned that rewards program, that's designed for kids who have reading difficulty. And so I think that's a better option there. In terms of like what to do for kids in general education, I don't know what the best answer is there. You know, there haven't been studies of this. Tiffany asked if, there are studies of this. There are not studies that have examined this carefully. I did a pilot study. We never had enough kids to do it, where we actually did that. And we've showed that with a very small effect in this very controlled study that like the, you know, teaching the rule was a little bit less beneficial than having the kids practice. I think one of the big messages I think from all of this is practice is essential. Simple rules, simple patterns, and massive amounts of practice, which I know you agree with because a lot of your research is really about opportunities to practice and develop your understanding.
Well, it's not practice in the sense of rote learning practice. It's practice in the sense of grouping items that follow similar patterns. So, you know, actually there's a lot more going on in the phonology of multisyllabic words than you get just from looking at these individual cases. There's trisyllabic laxing, there's other things that happen in the interaction between morphology and phonology. So things can look more arbitrary and things can look more complicated if you only focus on, for example, a certain number of syllable types that apply to words of certain lengths. Practice a number of opportunities to learn and so on is important. It's just not rote learning. It's finding patterns where they are, and they are all over the place. And it's grouping words so that, you know, the child is learning cabin is different from lapel or something. Lapel, do kids learn about lapels? Although I see, Devin, you have some nice lapels today.
Yes, thank you.
Anyway, today,
so I thought I wear white. So
okay, I'm not going to go on. I think what really needs to come across more. First of all, do you think you'll ever finish the study? In other words, look at what happens with the other rules, or is that? I mean, it takes time, but it could be done, right?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think, you know, online learning actually might offer us some advantages because it's very expensive and labor intensive to get into schools to do studies, especially of this size. And so my team has been starting to do a lot of work online in terms, we've been doing some intervention online. I think these are short studies, like we did like 6 lessons.
Actually,
that kind of thing could be really beneficial. Yeah, but we haven't done it. I mean, it can be done. I'd like to do it. We haven't yet.
I'm glad to hear that. I was actually raising a different question. So one is, one could do additional study to see whether there's some advantage in teaching such rules. I think that kind of research is very hard to do, and that it's very hard to draw conclusions from the studies often. And I'll say why in a moment. The other thing though was no, just the counting part. So when you look at the other rules,
right.
Are these the best rules? You know, if you look at CBCs, everything is great. So I guess the question is, you know, well, there are 6 rule types or 7 rule types here. And if you're gonna judge the costs and benefits, you need to know how consistent they are, all, you know, as a group. And right. I just wondered whether that was something that was feasible.
Yeah, so the other really prominent one is the VV rule, where the, you have a vowel, like a lion, where you have a vowel followed by a vowel. And I didn't look at that. I mean, you could, it's not complicated. I think what I did, and again, the editor insisted that I take some of the stuff out because it made the paper, even the appendices were too long. But I had actually written about like the number of occurrences of even like the phonological vowels and the number of cases where you had like a single letter vowel, because that's where the problem is, right? You get a reduction in the complexity if you have more than one letter in the vowel pattern. But if you have just one, it's especially challenging. And I wrote about that, and I can't remember, there are a lot of single letter vowels. I think it's like over 40% of vowels have one letter.
Yeah.
So it's a one letter followed by a consonant. So, you know, it applies to a lot of words. And in an earlier version of the paper, again, I had also done that. I sort of showed, like, if you think about all the times you might encounter a given vowel, like A, you know, the percentage of time is going to help, the rule is going to help you. I mean, you just sort of ratchet down until like the percentage of words where you're going to see the pattern work is like, you know, less than 10% or something.
So really here's the deal. Isn't this interesting? So I said something just glibly a moment ago about studies of the sort that you're planning to do. And I think that they're worth doing. They would be things like, you know, you do a small randomized control trial kind of study in which one classroom is using, is introduced to a rule, say for syllabification, and another classroom does something else. And you see whether introducing the rule is actually helpful. And we need to do studies of that sort. The problem with them is the real world doesn't necessarily end up working the same way because you can do things a lot better in a study of that sort in terms of teaching the rule clearly and having the kid really learn it well. The other thing though is, what could you have been doing instead, right? So a lot of studies that I see about classroom practices, basically, and I'm not talking about syllables specifically, follow exactly this sort of approach. They say, well, one class did this and another class, we had them do something else to see about the effectiveness of this particular kind of approach. And voila, after we did the study with a certain number of kids for a certain amount of time and we measured the improvement, we found that it was effective. The question is, well, what did you give up? I mean, what else could you have been doing instead? It's not enough just to show that some Also, what is the size of the effect? Is the effect long lasting? Is the size of the effect and how long it lasts, does that justify the procedure, which may involve vast amounts of time and effort that aren't really realistically possible to do in most schools? So yes, we need to see, does help teaching these rules help compared to some interesting alternatives? But we also need to ask, well, you know, is the language set up so that this is a good idea? If the language is set up so that the rules have lots of exceptions.
Right.
And there are many other things going on at the same time that are influencing pronunciation, like whether it's a noun or a verb influences mm-hmm. pronunciation and so on. Is it justified or should we be thinking about alternatives much more seriously? So I hope you do the studies, but I hope you also finish doing, or I'd love to help you find a way to do the counts for how consistent the other rules are as well. At some point, if you really look at how the language works and how many exceptions there are, and the fact that there are other things going on that will predict the patterns a little bit yep. better, you might then conclude, this really is not worth it. I should, unless perhaps the kid is, other things have failed.
Right. I think that's right. I mean, yeah, we have, you know, we've done a lot of kind of instructional studies like that. And, you know, I think, and some of them I think have been useful and I think some less so. I think that sometimes, you know, this is not exactly what you're saying. I'll come back to exactly what you're saying, but I think this is a useful point. Like a lot of times in education research, we've taken like the freight train method of, you know, doing a study. You pile a bunch of stuff in boxcars, you know, and, you know, you do a little bit of this, a little bit of this, a little bit of this, and you create some program and you, you know, run it down the track and, you know, see if it, I don't even know what, you know, blast through, you know, whatever. And so you basically, you know, but it's not targeted, right? It's, and we are, I think, we're also spending a lot of money on this when I think I've been sort of thinking a lot about the fact that we might be able to do more targeted studies. And I know that's not exactly what you're saying either, but I think one of the things I tend to do.
No, I don't want to be put off and I'm with you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I wanted to try to, you know, think in my own work about how can I do like a lot smaller scale studies to try to answer really precise questions. And so far, kind of what I described to you is about as far as I've gotten, but I have done, you know, a couple of things. And this, one of these was in the original version of this paper that this paper went through 7 revisions, by the way, that in the original version, I had actually done a comparison with how second, third and fourth graders were aware of the pattern, right, in words. So I basically gave them nonsense words that were controlled for all kinds of things, including morphology and medial vowels and all this kind of stuff. And the question was, are kids sensitive to the patterns, right? In other words, do they get that? And sort of like by comparing the frequency with which the pronunciation works in the language to what they actually say, does it match up, right? So are they actually sensitive to it? And it turned out that second graders are not, right? Because they have been given so much exposure to short vowel words that they, you know, and that's been the input, right? It's been a lot of short vowel words. And so they aren't sensitive to it. And third graders are somewhat. And fourth graders started to extract, I think, the signal and the noise, where it wasn't that they followed the rules, but the percentage of the time that they said like the long pronunciation or the short pronunciation lined up with the degree to which those rules were consistent in the language, which yeah. I thought was kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that really, you know, came from that was actually, it turns out the O rule like works a lot better than the other ones for the yeah. long vowels. So I think that, you know, that was another study that I liked that, you know, was sort of trying to not try to do another big instructional study, but try to get at some of these questions in a slightly different way. And
yes.
I think doing more, you know, studies you're talking about where we look at the language, I think that's huge. And I think if we can find ways in education to do studies that are much more like the ones that are done in, you know, psychology, I think that's helpful. Small scale, very targeted.
Can we just perseverate on this for a little while? Because I really agree with you. So obviously we're talking about a multi-pronged approach and not relying on one particular kind of evidence. One thing about the study that you did, it exemplifies something that a lot of people won't have encountered before, which is In people, for people who study language, reading, orthography, language comprehension, we have benefited enormously from the ability to analyze the structure of language using computational tools. So you can actually do something that you couldn't have done 15 years ago, which is take all of the common words in English and count how often do they exhibit one pattern or another. So you don't have to like guess. And you know, I think people, because they focus on the cases that follow the patterns, they might tend to overestimate how consistent the system is. In fact, it's pretty inconsistent at every level of language. So what you did was the data science part, which is let's count and see. And I think if people, and the data aren't complicated, you can see how often do they fall into one pattern or another. I think if educators and people who develop curricula and practices were more aware of just the basic facts about English, where the consistencies are, where the inconsistencies are, and so on, what we call the statistical properties of language, I think that would inform their choices about what to teach, because you don't want to teach things that have a lot of exceptions. You don't want to teach things that have a lot of extra conditions applied to associated with them. And so we could do people a service by conveying much more of that information. The other thing is about the types of studies. So I'm sensitive to, listen, I spent my life doing small scale studies with, 40 to, 500 kids, and very well designed, controlled, experiments in which we knew exactly the properties of the materials that we were using. We knew a great deal about the kids we were studying. We could follow through with them. We were not trying to ask about the effect of every possible environmental factor. We wanted to get at something basic about how reading works, what properties of print and sound and meaning are influencing how you learn to read, skilled reading, and so on. Those are smaller scale studies compared to the big randomized control trials that people think of as the gold standard for research. And what I would say is, first of all, those randomized control trial studies, God love you if you can do them. However, that kind of methodology really is very, which is based, of course, on the medical model of testing the effectiveness of a medication or something, COVID test, for example, it's very hard to extend that, have that as your primary source of evidence in something like early education or reading in particular. You know, in a randomized control trial with a drug, you try to factor out a few things, but basically you find out about the background of the people and so on, and any pre-existing conditions and so on, but basically everybody's getting the same medication. They're getting the same medication or placebo.
Right.
In a randomized controlled trial for an educational approach, it's as though, the medication that you're testing depends on the identity of the doctor and who the other people are in the room who are getting the medication at the same time, and a huge range of other cultural and contextual environmental factors that really, compared to the medical double-blind kind of randomized control trial, are far more complicated. It means that one can do such studies, but the range of questions that you can ask is not unlimited. And the answers that you get back might not be as useful as a set of smaller scale studies that really kind of look at individual pieces and try to see how they fit together. I'm trying to be pluralistic here and say, yeah, there's some randomized control trial studies in reading and early education that have been useful for sure. But those, given the expense involved and given the sheer number of factors that are involved, you cannot do a study in which you look rigorously at all the factors that are interacting to produce a particular outcome. And the results that you get from analyzing data of that sort are just not as clean cut as people might naively or wish, you know, wish for.
Yeah.
So let's do that kind of study, but let's look at this moderate size study in which we, you know, it's like a small randomized controlled trial study, right? You know, one classroom is going to take one approach, another classroom is going to take another approach. It's going to be watched very carefully. It's not massive numbers of kids, but it's enough to be able to do a reliable sort of get reliable data and so on. Mm-hmm. That kind of evidence is quite helpful. And you know, so I'm encouraging you to do that kind of work, especially if you can do it online now. Yeah. I just wanted to kind of maybe move the discussion a little bit away from thinking that randomized control trials are the only source of, that are done on things that are tried out in classrooms are not the only, the most important. I'm trying to move it away from the idea that that's the most important source of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I don't think it is. It's not where we've learned most of what we've learned about how reading works and so on.
Yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of the, I think that, like you said, we've learned some things. Like we know that, you know, across, you know, dozens, hundreds of studies now, phonics is effective. And there are even, you know, studies of like the long-term effects, and they show that, you know, phonics has a positive long-term outcome on kids' reading skills in various ways. But I think the results of these are really complicated for the reasons you're saying. And it's a little hard to extract, you know, exactly what's happened. You know, there's even cases where, you know, like it's hard to figure it out because of like the control or the comparison condition, right? Like, you know, who are those kids? And so, you know, like my doctor advisor, Doug Fuchs, and some other people did a study where they compared this group to one, they compared the same group, same treatment to kids in 1 year. And then 4 years later, after Reading First had started, the effect was the same, the growth was the same, the effect was not significant the second time around, possibly because of Reading First. So, you know, there are a lot of things like that that I think we need to consider. And I think, you know, I think you're making the point too, like we need a, you know, we need varied approaches to figuring these things out. And I think we can benefit more from, you know, looking at work like you've done. I mean, you did stuff, you know, on frequency and consistency effects in undergraduates that I think is, you know, some of those studies are relevant for our understanding. I mean, to the point we made really early on about syllable division, like Rebecca Treeman, who Molly knows well, did studies on like, you know, those medial sounds in words, right? And like whether or not they're, you know, ambisyllabic or whether or not they're in the first or second syllable. Really not easy to say, right? But that was one of the findings from her work. And so that's really important information that I think, you know, I feel like I've tried to read to understand that better and try to collaborate with people like you, because I think we can learn a lot from that. And even if we're gonna build, you know, a multi-component intervention, we can do that best if we have, you know, we look carefully at what's been learned in the cognitive literature, and we also do some of those studies ourselves. I'll just say one other thing, which is that the reason that randomized control trials in education became so popular in the early 2000s was that historically, that was not an expectation. The result was that a lot of things were endorsed that had no base in evidence because people had done kind of case studies of things. And so you can see how, you know, you know, and so that was where like Russ Whitehurst, who's the first, you know, director of IES, was like, we need to have gold standard studies so we can actually say if this works, you know, compared to something meaningful. And so I think that's where they came from. But I think we are overly limited if we do that. And I think that, you know, Mark Schneider's director of IES said a couple of years ago, he's worried about the fact that we haven't made tons and tons of progress in reading research, even though we spent a lot of money on it, you know?
Oh.
And so, you know, maybe there are other ways to, you know, benefit. And I think looking at some of these smaller studies, building them over time, I think there's one way to do it. I think, you know, you probably agree, ultimately we need some randomized control trials to kind of see whether or not all that put together really works. But the small studies are very important, and we haven't done enough.
I think this is a point of, you know, some, yes, I agree. I think it's a sophisticated, it's a more rational and sophisticated approach to evidence. So, you know, there are various kinds of evidence that are relevant to children's behavior, how reading works, things we're interested in, learning, and you know, like in the paper that you and Matt and I wrote for that issue of Reading Research Quarterly about, you know, Lost in Translation, we wanted to make a point of saying, you know, we need more research that really tries to connect theory to practice, which is true. But I feel like maybe we shouldn't give enough emphasis to the fact that that's not the only kind of evidence that allows people to make rational decisions about what to do. We have a lot of evidence from a variety of sources, which includes studies of kids and studies of adults and models of learning and many other things that suggest good practices. And it doesn't turn on having a single type of, you know, it certainly isn't limited to studies that were done in classrooms comparing method X to method Y. Mm-hmm. And I think in a future, some future on our website or somewhere, we really need to lay out, look, when you don't have, you can't just ask the question, does this program work better than this program? You have to be able to piece together evidence from a variety of sources which compellingly suggests, yeah, you need to teach some of those spelling sound correspondences, mm-hmm. because if you don't, it's going to be really costly. Yeah, you really need to consider the kids' spoken language vocabulary because a lot of other things depend on it. I mean, there are very compelling findings that I do think speak to what goes on in the classroom, even if it's not at the level of what is a very, very challenging and possibly, I don't even know if these things can be done, comparisons between the effectiveness of different programs. So we'll I think we need to come back with a little bit better discussion of, well, how does one make, look at the evidence? What kinds of evidence are relevant to making decisions about what happens in the classroom? The other thing goes back to something you mentioned a few minutes ago, which is, you know, when you do a large scale study, one of these $20 million studies funded by certain agencies, you cannot put all your eggs in one basket. You cannot just look at the effectiveness of one particular sort of aspect of, you know, a method. So typically what you'll have is, as you were, I think, saying, you'll have a multi-component program, and then you'll have the challenge of, you know, tracking kids over a period of time, seeing that there's good fidelity in how the programs are implemented and good comparisons between groups. And then at the end, you might indeed find that there are programs that work better, one program that works better than another, but you won't know exactly why. Because there, it's very, very, going to be very, very hard. You're going to reach the limits at the point where you try to tease apart, well, which of the six components of this program were the ones that were really responsible for the difference compared to the six in that? So that might be a really useful kind of practical study to do. It's not something that kind of gets at, well, what are the really essential components of reading that every program should have?
Right.
It's tough. Right. It's a tough job, but, you know, this is what we're where we're at.
Yeah. I mean, so I think some people have started to try to do that. I think Ed Reports that does, they actually kind of take in sort of the, you know, ask experts, what are kind of the best practices in this area? And then they've looked at programs and tried to classify them in terms of whether they have, you know, some kind of, you know, the degree to which the activities match what works. And it's actually like, if you look at evidence for ESSA, which has, you know, the guidance that came out in the Obama administration about how to rank programs, the first level of evidence was basically like you have a rationale, which I've always interpreted as you basically like came up with good things based on other sources of data, right? And so, like, you know, they counted that as a level of evidence. They didn't say it was very high level of evidence, it was the lowest level, but they said that on that basis, you know, you could make a claim about something, you know, program having some value. I think the challenge is always then whether people, you know, it's easy to get a lot of things in under that kind of, you know, system that really don't have evidence, but sort of pay lip service to something or another. And, you know, it's hard to tease that apart. But I think that some of those efforts to look at components of programs, those are really useful because, you know, we don't always have randomized control trial. I mean, I did a study of this, you know, a few years ago, looking at programs that teach morphology. You know, we looked at, you know, like there were like 40 or 50 programs we looked at. Only six of them were in the What Works Clearinghouse for IES. And so, like, you know, sort of like, are we going to do, you know, a randomized control trial on every one of these, or can we classify them in terms of the degree to which they include evidence of effective practice and maybe learn something that way?
It's tough. I think there's clearly, there is more research. There is good research out there, and there's more research that that needs to be done to look at some of these ideas about which people are really at loggerheads. I mean, should we be teaching morphology? When should we be teaching it? Is it something that you need to make explicit, or can you just lead kids into it? And similarly, syllables and other sorts of things. We need more research, no question. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that there is, you know, what we call converging evidence from a lot of different sources about very basic principles about, you know, the role of the kids' knowledge of spoken language prior to school entry, their knowledge of the world, things, their ability to what's involved in learning about print, how kids learn. You know, I think people are just catching up with where the literature is at, has been for a while, where, you know, there's some balance between explicit instruction, but also a lot of what's called implicit statistical learning. How do you set up educational experiences and environments to promote both of those kinds of learning? There's a huge amount of evidence that bears on really basic properties of learning to read and what a good program will incorporate. And that's despite the fact that the studies on a large scale are very ferociously difficult to do. And often the data that they yield is kind of like wishy-washy. I mean, it says that certain factors matter, and exactly how much they matter and how much to balance them and how they influence one another, that becomes an exceedingly difficult statistical analysis. And I'm not clear that all of the results necessarily translate into do this, not that.
Yeah.
So we're just acknowledging it's a tough field.
Right. Yeah, I think, I mean, So to Mara's point, like, the lesson is, you know, we don't teach syllables, like, as Mark says, there's a better way. I don't think that's the takeaway. I think the takeaway is that the characteristics of the language, which is one kind of analysis, didn't support the idea that these work particularly well. The other thing that I kind of just reviewed, summarized in that paper, like, it wasn't a meta-analysis or anything, was other options, right? And Anna mentioned, like, that the, you know, Anita Archer Rewards approach was really kind of like syllable division, except without that name. And I agree with that, Anna. Like, it was in a sense breaking the words apart, but not doing it with this complex rule kind of component. And so if you take those two sorts of evidence together, that I think is an indication of sort of like, we now have kind of, I think to your point, Mark, converging information. The language doesn't seem to have those characteristics. And then when you do look at, you know, studies of different programs and so on, like, it doesn't seem to work. And the rewards doesn't have a lot of evidence, but one by Rolando O'Connor and colleagues called Bridges, like, they did find that that was effective. That was a big part of their program. It's messy evidence. But one of the things that makes me think is that, you know, we should in the field be doing more studies, like syntheses of the literature that are kind of interdisciplinary syntheses.
Yes, right? Definitely.
So it's like, you take the linguistic information from studies like mine. We take the, you know, small scale, even adult information from studies like yours. Computational modeling. We take information from randomized control trials. Like, it's just, you know, I think we can draw better conclusions if we look at everything. I think that was, you know, that's, I think I hadn't thought about that before today, but I think that's one of the big takeaways from all of this, including the paper we had, is that, you know, like, we actually said that. That was, like, I think point one was to do more interdisciplinary collaborations, which a lot of folks have, you know, made the point of saying, including a paper in the Reading Research Quarterly special issue by a whole bunch of folks, including some on the meeting today. But, they, you know, we haven't talked about doing syntheses across disciplines so much. And I think that's a really cool thing to do, so that we can actually extract the signal from multiple sources.
So I think one thing Molly and I have talked about, and, you know, it's on a long list of things that need to be done, is to talk about how people, researchers, weigh evidence. What they do is they're not looking for the knockout study that says this method was better than that. What they're looking for is converging evidence from a variety of really solid sources. One is the language. It's what you're doing is consistent with the way the language works. You're not treating the language in a weird way. Like, to me, treating rabbit as though there's a syllable boundary between the two B's is kind of doing damage to the language, because that's not really true. But let's leave that one aside. You want to know about how the language works. You want to know about how kids learn from different kinds of instruction or different kinds of experiences. You want to know different ways of being able to group stimuli, group words, group patterns, group sequences of words, so that you get the most learning out of the experience. What I'm saying is, yes, we could, in fact, that's how researchers think about what can I conclude from research? If I put together all these things, they're all pointing in the same direction and saying, this is a really important thing to include and to do well. So we could do much more of that. I think the field needs a much better a successor to the reading rope, which really talks about, incorporates a bit more of our modern conceptions about how learning works and how, and we know much more about how spelling works, how phonology works, how semantics works. We know so much more about the data structure that we could create a new set of sort of principles or guidelines. I have that as a goal. We're gonna run out of time if we don't.
Before we finish up on today, can I try to be the like voice of a teacher listening and try to see if I'm getting what I should do in my classroom? And if not, you can redirect me from listening. I guess, so just like thinking about practically, okay, what am I gonna do if I step into the classroom and we're thinking, okay, these syllable types are like too much overwhelming, too much to teach. I think the thing I've taken away from listening to you two talk is thinking about this idea of like the cognitive load, the how much is it taking me out of reading? And so like the first level of instruction, that general instruction for the entire classroom, is trying to be like as doing as little of that as possible, because for a lot of kids, they're going to be fine without that, as long as they're getting all of those word sounding out strategies, all of the decoding knowledge that they need to have. Then it's that differentiating instruction, paying attention to the kids who are like, they're not getting that. And maybe we've moved on to, you know, multi-syllable, two syllable words, and suddenly something's not clicking and they need an actual like kind of explicit strategy to go with. And that one, it seems like, so then the next step would be maybe to try to think about telling them explicitly to do a little vowel flexing, or, you know, try the short, try the long, that would be like a next incremental step. And then maybe then there might be kids beyond that, that we're actually having these explicit strategies of thinking about syllable types might be the actual scaffolding they need, but that would not be my first step to go there. Because again, as we've talked about, trying to think about the most useful use of my time, my limited time in the classroom, that seems like it's going to be overkill for a lot of kids.
I think that's a really good summary. It you know, we're not dictating anything here. We're trying to raise awareness and also give people additional things to work with. So we can tell you more about whether that strategy that you're teaching, how often it's going to work and where it's going to fail. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a useful thing to know. And other things, but.
Oh, and I guess the other thing you raised too was thinking about maybe in thinking about instruction, grouping words so that it helps kids pick up on, okay, a lot of these words are doing a short vowel. A lot of these words are doing a long vowel. Like, these are the two kind of options. So
yeah. Yeah, I think neighborhoods of words got a bad reputation for reasons I need to understand historically, but certainly there are ways of grouping words that can promote learning. Here's the thing. I don't think we're trying to say to people, if you're using this syllabic, relying on teaching the different kinds of syllables, you're doing the wrong thing. What we're trying to say is, we do need to think about other alternatives, because it's a costs versus benefits kind of situation. And while we're doing the best we can with the tools we have, we can also be looking forward to where we can improve. The concern I have, which I've stated here in these meetings several times, is that this pendulum has swung very heavily in some places, in the direction of teaching kids a lot of explicit stuff, you know, things you can put in words. That is another kind of memorization.
And maybe came from a worry about teachers not having enough knowledge about the structure of English. So that's like another piece that we've touched on a little here, is that like teachers, it could help them to know about syllable structures, exceptions and rules, but that doesn't mean that the kids have to be explicitly taught all those things.
So rather than criticizing what people's current practices are, it's more giving people a sense of that there are other things that we can think about. My general concern, which is not just about syllables, is we're treating reading and spelling as a bunch of rules that the kid has to learn. And that's another kind of rote learning. And moreover, it doesn't quite fit with how English, written and spoken English, work. And it doesn't take enough advantage of kids' ability to pick up on patterns, statistical patterns, regularities without explicit instruction or without a huge amount of instruction. So it's kind of trying to just widen the awareness of the possibilities as we really work towards figuring out new ways to balance practices. And again, we don't want people to walk away from these things panicked about, am I doing it wrong? You're not hurting your kids. It's just a question of always trying to evaluate ourselves and figure out if we can do things better.
Yeah, I would add, a friendly amendment is that I would strongly consider maybe not teaching syllable types, even though, I mean, I don't think it's like the worst, you know, I mean, the attempt is to help kids, right? I think one shared idea is that we're all trying to help kids. I'm not convinced that's the best idea, especially since there are other ones that work. I also think too, you know, there are some principles that I think are also based in cognitive science, like Sarah Hart put in the chat, you know, every syllable has at least one vowel is a really great example. That, like, the importance of vowel letters has been shown in cognitive science and in education. It's in the Bridges program by Orlando O'Connor, like Iris Berendt and Fabienne Chate, like they've shown this to be true in cognitive studies, right? And so we know that vowels are good anchors. And so I think that idea of like breaking things according to vowel, you know, like identify where the vowel letters are, break it accordingly, I think is important. That's one example of kind of this, you know, learning from multiple disciplines. The other thing that I think you alluded to, Mark, but I want to add, just maybe piggyback on, is the importance of practice. I mean, my general thought is limited, like really simple rules, lots of practice. And one thing I'll just add about the rules is, if kids have reading difficulty, there's a good chance they have language processing challenges. And so then you want to add on that they need to memorize and explain a rule, you know, something that's already difficult for them to do is to explain the language. That is also really concerning to me. Even the magic E rule, this is a whole other conversation, like I really dislike, because I don't think you need to know the rule to identify the pattern. And asking kids to identify the pattern adds a lot of language to what should be something, I think, more simple. And so I think those would be my friendly amendments to what you say is, you know, there are some things like marking vowels, which come from lots of sources, and that practice is essential. Simplicity and practice, and the simpler way, even for kids with reading difficulty, the simplest way you can find to explain something that, and then follow it up by mass amounts of practice, that is going to make a dramatic difference.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Well, thanks to everybody. I guess we should probably let people go enjoy their weekend, the rest of the weekends. So there were a lot of questions in the chat, and we will definitely post responses. There weren't a lot last week, but this week there are, and so we'll post responses and try to expand on a few of these issues and follow up. I mean, we don't think, you know, the articles that Devin wrote and the one we wrote together, they're pretty, for research articles, they're pretty accessible. and they're, so if you want them, we can they're downloadable from our websites. We'll just carry on.
I add one point? I cite Trevor Noah and Eddie Izzard, who are both very funny comedians.
Yeah.
Paper, which is, you got to at least read that far because,
okay.
Sorry, go back to what you were saying.
Okay, I'm going to stop. Next week we're off because of Father's Day. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
And the week after, Julie Washington will be with us. Julie and I published a paper recently that I'm pretty proud of that paper. I think it was a lot of hard work and it might actually make a difference for kids. But she'll be here and we'll be able to talk about some of the controversial issues. And of course she's like Devin, the kind of person you really want to have a conversation with. So that'll be great. After that, we have some plans for probably doing some, spending some sessions, which we'll record, of course, that deal with some issues that are kind of generating a lot of, I think, let's just say, uncertainty or confusion. And starting with what phonemes are and what phonemic awareness is and where it comes from and how it develops and what kinds of practices or experiences are relevant to it. And a number of issues that where the science kind of is pretty clear, but the practices are all over the place. So Molly and I are going to try to really work on to do some things that, pardon?
Return to the cognitive science.
We're going
to
do the science in a way that we hope is as accessible as these discussions have been. There'll be more pictures, but probably we're not sure on the details yet. Probably most people are going to want to do them asynchronously, not like just on Sunday afternoon. But really, we'd like to do some teaching. I mean, a little bit of explaining. It's summer and maybe people have time to, who are interested will have time to think about some of these well-chosen, difficult issues. So we'll have more information about that in 2 weeks. But in the meantime, Devin, thank you so much. You're like the best example of someone who really has his feet in both the classroom and working with teachers and people who develop curricula, and also does really compelling research. So thanks for being a colleague. Thanks for being a friend. Thanks for being here. And we'll make sure that all the hard questions get sent to you for answers, okay?
Thanks for having me. This was really, really fun.
It was fun.
Yes, all right.
See you, Molly.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this reading meeting recording. You can find more information about past and future reading meetings on our website. We hope you'll join us for future meetings.